really glad you're here for Sundays with the Modern. Today we have Anne Lawrence. I'll give a little background on Anne and then turn it over to her for what promises to be a wonderful tour. Anne is an art historian, educator, and curator in Dallas. She is the former director of the Contemporary Art Dealers of Dallas and CAD Art Lab, and was the assistant director of road agent Christina Reese's Gallery in DeBellum, in the DeBellum area of Dallas. Previously, she worked at the Dallas Museum of Art for 5.5 years and has taught at local universities and colleges. She received her MFA in art history from the University of North Texas in Denton and currently is pursuing independent curating and writing projects. So that gives you a little bit of background. I'm going to turn it over to Anne and we'll get started.
All right, thank you. Terry. So today we're really going to focus on two pieces that are new acquisitions here at the Fort Worth Modern. We're going to start with the Solowit, and then we're going to move through the Minimalist Galleries, and then we're going to go up to the Dan Flavin. So if you'll follow me, we'll get started. So this is the room we're going to be in. So you can see there's plenty of space if you want to spread out in here. And there are stools available at the front if you decide you need one. We're not too far from the front now. All right. So, how many docents do I have here today? See a handful over here. And how many of you have been to the Modern before? A couple. Okay, so we have some first-timers here. Great. How many of you have heard of this artist, Solowit? Anybody? Okay. We've got all the docents. You should be accounted for. All right. Great. Well, Solowit is considered a major artist of the 20th century. He was really important to a number of movements, minimalism as well as conceptual art. So today we're going to be talking about both of those. This is, well, what do you see here? What is this? I'll give you a hint. It's called a wall drawing. All right? You probably could have figured that one out. Do you want to get a little closer? What do you see? Close as you can. What do you think it's made of? Is it paint? Someone said fabric. Someone said paper. What about colored pencil? Nods. Okay. All right, colored pencil. Great. All right. Can you figure out how he did it? Or how, what the technique is? I'll let you keep looking at it, and I'll tell you a little bit more about Solowit. He's actually from Connecticut. He studied art when he was young. He enjoyed going to the Wadsworth Athenaeum, his local museum, much like you in Fort Worth may come here, to the Kimball or to the Modern, and so on. He took classes at his museum. He then went on to Syracuse University, where he received a Bachelor of Fine Arts, and then was drafted into the Korean War. If you want, you can step back, or you can sort of move wherever you're comfortable. I don't want you to get too far away, because then it's hard to see. But so Solowit is someone who had a number of experience in his life, right? Goes to school, goes off to war, and then comes back to New York. Well, while he was in Korea, he actually worked as a graphic designer, making posters for the special services. And so when he comes back to New York, he goes to work for 17 Magazine. Does that sound exciting? doing photostats, mechanicals, paste ups, all the things that a graphic designer in the late 1950s would do. After that, he goes to work for an architect named I.M. Pei as a graphic designer, another pretty good gig. Before deciding he really, really wants to be an artist, and so he takes an entry-level job at the Museum of Modern Art, because that's the place to be. And while there, he meets a number of other artists, like-minded artists, like Dan Flavin, the other artist we're going to talk about today. He also meets Robert Ryman, Lucy Lepard, and other people who are going to be asking questions very similar to the questions he's asking about art. So in the 50s, we see artists such as the gallery we just passed through over there has a work by Jackson Pollock. So Jackson Pollock, Willem de Kooning, the abstract expressionists had become really, by this time, the dominant form of art. And so there are younger artists doing what younger artists do, which is question what just happened. They want to know, how do we flip this over onto its head? So, do any of you know anything about abstract expressionism? Well, let's think about the word. I say expressionism, that means sort of what's inside would be an expression on the outside. So artists like Jackson Pollock are sort of, you know, use great slashing strokes of paint and these big heroic paintings that are going to be sort of this angst, everything that's inside coming out through the paint onto the canvas. So expressionism. Abstract, what do you think? Does that mean they're drawing ponies? No, they're drawing things that are non-representational. So it's just about the paint on the canvas. So it's this very internal experience being externalized, so capturing this moment in paint. It has to do with the unconscious, with automatic drawing. So there are lots of theories and things that go along with it. So these younger artists, they're going to flip that over. One of the things they're trying to do is make it not so much about the internal life of the artist being put out onto the canvas. Instead, they want it to be an art that is self-sufficient. So it becomes about the art and its experience with the viewer. So externalizing things. Well, there are a number of techniques and things that they're experimenting with, such as, what if it doesn't look like I made it? So with abstract expressionism, it's all about this idea of autograph, the individual hand. How do you take the hand of the artist away? Any ideas? You have someone else do it. You buy something that's already made, something like a ready-made, like what Marcel Duchamp had done. Or you have something industrially fabricated, such as what we're going to see with Donald Judd when we move over there. So, well, these things don't happen in a vacuum. Around 1962, the British historian Camilla Gray published a book called The Great Experiment. It was a survey of Russian art. I bring that up because she is able to put forward more information about a number of artists in Russia, such as Vladimir Tatlin and Alexander Radchenko. They had certain ideas about constructivism focusing on the materials and focusing on space. And it's those two ideas, materials and space, that the minimalists are going to pick up on. Constructivism was known, but the version of it that had come through to the West really had been about Antoine Pevsner and Naum Guibaud, who were building on cubism, so Picasso, Braque, and so on. Well, their version, if you go over to the Nasher, you can see the wonderful Naum Guibaud, where he's using these materials to sort of slice open the planes of the figures, but it's a figure, it's a bust. So the motif still feels very traditional. It's the human figure. And that is what they didn't want at all. They didn't want the human figure. So the emphasis on materials and space as seen through Tatlin and Radchenko are much more interesting to the minimalists. So I'm just throwing out this word minimalist as if you guys all know what I'm talking about, right? It's not a term that they used at the time, and they didn't like the labels. There were a number of things thrown out there, and it's one of those things where art historians look back and go, oh, these guys all have something in common, they were working together, therefore we refer to them as the minimalists. It's a very easy way of categorizing things. I'll talk to you a little bit more about what Saul LeWitt thought about these labels in just a moment, because he wrote about it. But when I say conceptual art, Saul LeWitt definitely called it conceptual art. He wrote about it specifically and said, this is what I think. And that's a really wonderful resource for us now to go back and look at. So up to this point, I haven't really told you about what he's making. He had been making some paintings, and then he started making boxes. And then he's talking to his friends and thinking about what I just mentioned about constructivism, about materials, about space. And he starts breaking the boxes open so that he's just showing the frame. And he starts thinking in series. So we refer to it as a serial art, not cornflakes, but series, serial. And the other artists, his friends, Flavin, Judd, they're thinking about how do we take the art down off the pedestal? We want it to be in your space. So we're going to put it directly on the floor. So he's making these things that look like grids. They look like construction. You might actually accidentally think it was a piece of furniture or something. But Saul LeWitt had this very specific idea. Art is not utilitarian. Art is not architecture. Architecture has to be utilitarian. If this building fell down, it's not a good building. But art doesn't have to be. And he again, wrote about it, and that's like really wonderful that we can read exactly what he said. But the constructivists thought the opposite. They thought art should have a social purpose. And so with Tatlin and others, it was all about this greater art and the purpose of social and political purpose, so art and design. So Tatlin's most well-known piece is Monument to the Third Republic. Yes, sorry, that sounded right. Monument to the Third Republic from 1919 to 1920. It's a piece that's never built. He builds a model of it, but it's this fantastic sort of fantasy tower that a German artist of the time said, art is dead, long live Tatlin's machine art. So artists are grappling with what modernism, what machinery, what it means, and what it can be. So this is how Saul LeWitt is thinking about it early on. It's grids, it's going to be structures, it's going to look like girders, but we're going to move one piece out and make many, many versions of that. So I'm going to refer to my notes now. In 1967, he writes an article for an art publication of the time called Art Forum, which is still around. Any of you guys know about this one, Art Forum? All right. And I'm going to read just a little bit about it, because what he does is he outlines conceptual art. It's called Paragraphs on Conceptual Art. In conceptual art, the idea or concept is the most important aspect of the work. When an artist uses a conceptual form, it means that all of the planning and decisions are made beforehand, and the execution is a perfunctory affair. The idea becomes a machine that makes the art. And he goes on to explain in great detail how this kind of work would function. But let's go back to this last sentence. What do you think the most important thing I just said was? Right, the idea is a machine that makes the art. He's thinking this through, and it takes about a year before he makes his first wall drawing. So this was 67, 68, at Paula Cooper Gallery in New York. He makes wall drawing number one, and he sets out the protocol of what he's going to do for the rest of his career, which is he is going to write a series of instructions, he is going to draw it directly on the wall, just like we have here. This is 1970. This is wall drawing 50A, so you can see how long he's been doing it. In this article, he goes on to explain that the artist will come up with the idea from start to finish in his mind before anything is done. It is completely done. He's separating the artist from the technician or from the draftsman and saying it is the idea that is the machine that makes the art, right? So how exactly does that work? Any ideas? Any ideas? So I'll talk about the instructions for this one in just a second. But I do want to mention, before I forget, that he makes a number of jokes through this piece, and I think that's really important, that it really humanizes the reading, and it makes it much easier to get through. And I love that at the very end he says, if any of this was unclear, it's because there was unclear thinking. Mm-hmm. So kind of acknowledging that perhaps this could be a little difficult, but that he tried his hardest to make it as clear as possible. But my favorite part is when he's throwing around the names that other people are using for minimalist art. He says, I don't know anyone doing any of these things that you're describing, and that critics must be writing in some kind of code to each other, but that mini art, so M-I-N-I, art was one of the terms, and he says, mini art must be about miniskirts and long-legged girls. That perhaps mini art shows could travel in matchboxes around the country. And that, or maybe it's artists who are all under 5 feet tall. They're making mini art. So we see that Solowit, he's actually really quite funny. In conclusion, he says, conceptual art is only good when the idea is good. He also, in another article, said, two-dimensional works are not seen as objects. The work is a manifestation of an idea, and it's an idea, not an object. Which brings me back to, why is he drawing directly on the wall? We have him putting the sculpture directly on the floor in order to be in our space with us. If you think about traditionally how a drawing is made, it is on a piece of paper, which is then matted, framed, hung on the wall. Perhaps it's on canvas, which is then over a wooden stretcher, which is then, again, hung or perhaps even framed and put on the wall. So he's thinking, how do I break down these barriers? I know. We're going to get rid of the paper, get rid of the canvas. We're going to draw directly on the wall itself, as we see here. Well, what do you think are the logical conclusions of drawing directly on the wall? It's stuck. It's here, right? What else? Are you going to show all your friends this piece? No, they have to go to the location. They have to see it for themselves. Right, it becomes situational. It becomes part of the architecture itself. Anything else? Well, I think that you hit on the first one, that it doesn't move, right? If it was a painting or on a canvas, you could lend it to another institution, you could take it home, you could see it in the gallery, you'd say, oh, I'll put it over my sofa, you know, and then maybe I'll put it in storage, and so on. So it has a very different life here. It exists as the instructions. The work of art doesn't go away if you paint over the wall itself. And Solowit writes out some very specific thoughts and guidelines about that the idea is the art. That is what conceptual art is. This is the manifestation of that idea, and it doesn't matter whether he draws it or not. Now, this is going back to a very old idea in art, that you could have a master and a workshop, apprentices, and so on. And we see it in the other arts just fine. Who built this building? Do you guys know?
No.
But who do we give credit for the building? Right, the Japanese architect, Taito Ando. Did he lay this brick? No. So, same thing with composers, with musicians. You have someone who writes a symphony. Does he have to play the clarinet, the bassoon, the tympanum? Does he play everything? No. So he's just expanding those ideas into art, into contemporary art. But it was considered a bit radical at the time. And for some people, it still is kind of unsettling. If I say this is by Solowit, but I can tell you that I know who actually drew it, how do you feel about that? What if I tell you he passed away, so he couldn't have done it? Does that... Okay.
And I can tell you that when we had the drawing room show at the other building, to make your point,
mm-hmm.
I had students who I think saw themselves as being fairly progressive thinking people, and they were it tortured them to know that the artist himself had not labored over that, over those pieces, that in fact the security and installation staff at the museum had made those pieces. Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us how long this one took?
Do you know? It took about 8 hours a day.
Right.
More people working.
Right. So there are people from Solowitz Estate who will come and help supervise. But if you want to deinstall this piece, how do you, when I say deinstall, I mean take down. How would you take down this piece?
White paint.
White paint. That's right. You just paint over it. I think that's hard for people to realize that 5 weeks of eight people working, of a crew of people working 8 hours a day, and it's just going to be gone when they paint over it. The museum may not, but the dealers would. So I mentioned it was at Paula Cooper's gallery, right? So I think that that's an interesting question. I didn't investigate this too much, but I think that is very interesting, because you might think that drawing on the wall means it's ephemeral. Well, he's dead and still here. It's not that ephemeral. You might think it's anti-commodity. He had galleries. They sold his work. His work is collected by institutions. So each of those questions that you might throw up, he's still able to overcome them. So, over time. It may not have happened immediately.
If we want to sell this piece to somebody else, can we get that same crew of people go work in that house?
No. No, in fact, the crew was specific to this institution. You used people who worked here already. So they wouldn't travel to... You might have some people from his estate to come supervise.
It would be a contract, the instructions.
The instructions,
yeah.
Right. So let me get to the instructions, since we're talking about that. He says it's... So this is wall drawing, number 50A from 1970. So we're very new into this. If you consider his entire life... he's only been doing this for a couple of years, and this is number 50 of all the wall drawings that he's made. Here are the instructions. A wall divided into four parts by lines drawn from corner to corner. Okay. All right. Each section with three different colors made of parallel lines superimposed, color pencil. Would you have drawn something that looks like this if you were given those instructions? Maybe. Exactly. Maybe, maybe not. He left it open. There, you could give this to 100 different people and have 100 different versions made. I think that's very liberating. For me, this diagonal reminds me of the piecing of a quilt. I think when you come close, it reminds me of a weaving. You have these different colors. So as we're all standing back, what colors do you see here? How would you generally describe this center right quadrant?
Purple.
All right. What about the left side?
Peach,
orange, center? Center, I think, is kind of difficult. Even in photography, it looks kind of
beige,
tan. I keep wanting to say white, but I know it's not white. There's so much color on it. And top?
Green.
Are you familiar with the color wheel?
No.
All right, let me show you one. I'll just thank my iPad for the color wheel. Right. So I've just told you that this is made up of three colors, and you've just described more than three colors to me. And I know you've come close, and you can come close again if you want to look. So the colors that are actually used are not purple, blue, and orange. It is red, there you go, red, blue, yellow, and actually a graphite. It definitely looks like there's a graphite in there. So it's kind of a light gray-black. All right, so when you mix these two colors, blue and red, as he's done here, so we have blue lines coming this way and we have red lines coming in a diagonal, your eye is optically blending them to make the secondary color, which is this color that's directly in between violet, between the red and blue. And same thing with what you see over there. So if you look closely, it's not orange. It is red and yellow. So red and yellow, and they make orange right there on your color wheel. And I will say from painting, trying to make green is kind of tricky. It's going to come out a little too blue. And that's what you have up there with the blue and the yellow combining to make green. Like that. Any questions about color? Did you know that your eye would do that? That it would blend the colors together even though they're not actually blended? Yeah. Yes. The lines go through all of it. There actually isn't blue in this section. What you see is the graphite. So here, there's no blue. It's just the red and yellow. Here, there's no yellow. It's just the red and blue. And that's what makes... It's the size of the wall.
It had to be, or any wall, yeah. Whatever the wall is.
Whatever the wall.
Okay.
So that's not really right. All that new, because Seurat was playing with that also.
Oh, absolutely. Artists have always played with optical blending and color theory. If you were looking at the wheel, you might have noticed that the colors that are opposite each other tend to intensify each other. So think about Christmas, red and green, they're opposite each other. If you look at red and green together, it's almost like they vibrate because they're so bright together. Same thing with blue and orange, purple and yellow. I think that's why a lot of sports teams and schools use those complementary colors in order to come up with really sort of bright, iconic images there. So he's drawing on the wall in order for it to not be a three-dimensional object. He wants it to be in your space, directly on the wall. He's figured out ways for it not to be completely ephemeral, for it to be treated as a commodity because it is the instructions, therefore it can be sold, it can be moved, it can be borrowed. And he makes quite a career making hundreds of these. And there are some really amazing places you can go, such as at the Mass MoCA. You can see over 100 wall installations, wall drawings by Solowit that he supervised while he was still living. What the plan was for that. It's a converted textile mill, an old building. And it's a 30-year exhibition that went up in 2008, so you better hurry. It'll be gone before you know it. But don't you think they're going to be sad when they have to paint those walls? So in the 1970s, LeWitt moves to Italy. And I mention this because there are a number of things that are going to profoundly influence him. If I say Italy, you think art, what happened with Italian art. He is exposed intimately with work from the artists from the Quattrocento, so 15th century Italian artists such as Masaccio, Fra Angelico, Giotto, Lippi. These are people who drew on walls. They painted on walls. And they used a fresco technique. Do you know what a fresco is? Okay, docents, very good. They know what a fresco is. All right. So think about what a pain it is to remodel your house. Imagine if you want to decorate your wall, you have to lay down new plaster and then put up a cartoon, in other words, a drawing, and then you can only do as much as you can cover in one day before the plaster dries. So the painting is going to become part of the wall as the plaster dries. If you made a mistake and you need to go back, it's going to be really obvious because you're going to have to replaster it and rework it. So this whole wall drawing, this is very, very old. And that's a real eye-opener to Solowit. And it actually changes his colors. The colors that you see in a fresco are going to be this kind of dusty, sort of muted colors. They're not going to have these really intense colors like an oil paint. So he starts using inks that you're then going to rub into the wall and then you're going to wash off You're going to stain the wall. And then you're going to do layer after layer after layer, much like in oil paint you would make glazes, so that you have this really rich depth of color inside. You can actually see an example of one of these pieces in Dallas. Are you familiar with the Solowitz installation at the Dallas Museum of Art? Have any of you been to the Dallas Museum of Art? Even if you've been, it's very possible you might have missed it, because it's in the barrel vault. And not when you walk in, you have to turn around. It's directly up above. So if you see the fountain, the sort of circular courtyard, you come in, and it fits exactly into the barrel vault there. And it's made in this technique. It was actually designed in 83 and, or instructed in 83 and then installed in 85. And I just want to throw in, before we leave this piece, that as Aaron mentioned, I worked at the DMA, and I remember being in an exhibitions meeting where someone had brought up the idea that a museum wanted to borrow the Solowit. So what does that mean? They're like, well, can we just put something over it? Can we just hide it? Rather than have to have, because this is a very, very labor-intensive process with all of these inks and everything. And ultimately, they ended up not doing it. But they would have had to have destroyed the piece. They would have had to have painted over it in order for it to have gone someplace else. So with that, let's go ahead and we're going to go visit some other minimalist artists. Oh, I'm sorry. Are there any questions?
So just a question.
Sure.
So in Italy, his colors were influenced by Italian fresco?
Yes.
His application or the directions for the application were influenced, but not his intentionality, I'm going to say. He wasn't moved by the Renaissance idea of the fresco becoming bound into the wall forever. He didn't go...
Right, not forever. Right. Mm-hmm. But definitely the idea of art as being part of the environment. Art is part of the space that the viewer is in, the living space. So that's, yeah. We'll move on to the next space, but that's a really interesting question. Past the Jenny Holzer installation, so we're just going to walk past it. We don't step on it or anything. Oops. We're going to be in here for a little while. We're going to start by looking at the Donald Judd. And I wanted to bring you through this way so that you walked through the minimal gallery. But we're going to be looking in here. Okay, so we just came through the galleries here. Oh, you probably saw the Jenny Holzer piece, the light moving. Isn't that beautiful? New installation here, another new acquisition. And you may also have noticed the Dan Flavin right around the corner, and we'll talk about that in just a moment, but I wanted to actually come through that gallery to talk about this piece. Yeah, I left my 2-year-old at home today. Because of that. all right, so this is an artist that I've been mentioning, right? Donald Judd. Kind of thrown his name out there a couple of times. He was another artist who was, like Solowit, asking similar questions about materials, about space. He wanted this idea of, like the constructivists, sort of truth in materials. So it's metal, he's removed the hand of the artist, he's actually having to use an industrial fabricator. He's writing instructions someone else is making it. Sounds kind of familiar? Is this on a pedestal? No, it's hung on the wall, but in such a way that it joins from floor to ceiling. So he's physically bridging the space that we're in. Here. There's another author that I want to mention, and that's Maurice Merleau-Ponty. His book, Phenomenology and Perception, had been written in 1945, but it was translated into English in 1962. And he is writing about this idea that meaning is a function of the body's immersion in the world. Have you ever heard of phenomenology? That's a great word, just a nice, big, chunky, fat word. But it refers, it's the study of structures of consciousness as experienced from the first person point of view. If you remember earlier, I've been talking about the abstract expressionist, this idea of something that's interior coming out. With artists like Judd, he wants it to be about our experience, our first-person experience with this here. It's not about him as a person or whether he liked the color orange or pink. It's more about how we are experiencing it here in space. I say space. What do you notice about space with this? It's equidistant. They're the same. He really liked this idea of eliminating compositional hierarchy, which is a fancy way of saying the fifth one can be replaced with the sixth one, which could be replaced with the third one. They are all exactly alike. They are discrete units that can be replaced with each other. And you can see, well, not from here, but when you came in, maybe, you might have seen the Carl Andre piece on the floor. It's a series of metal plates, or what you might think of as little rugs, on the ground. Metal, each plate, almost identical. They could be switched around. They're industrially fabricated. They're on the floor. So all these ideas, over and over, interpreted different ways. Before we move to Flavin, just around the corner, I just wanted to mention that there's one more artist that was extremely influential to Solowit, and it's totally unexpected. Like, you would never think that this is the artist that perhaps set all of this in motion, and that's Edward Muybridge. Did you see that one coming? Yeah, seriality. Right. So, Edward Muybridge was a photographer. Who's known for his studies of animal locomotion in the 1870s, the 1880s. He'd been hired to settle a bet about whether or not when a horse is running, all of the feet actually leave the ground. You guys know the answer? So, yeah. And this one, yep, you can see it right there. They do. Well, this sets up his entire, the rest of his career. He is going to do hundreds of studies of animal locomotion. It's an idea that is going to be repeated, a very specific set of instructions, over and over. Here it is with a bird. He's going to set it up from multiple angles, and he is going to investigate this. So, seriality, intent, idea, that then essentially an idea that becomes a machine that produces the art. And you can see that with Solowit's sculptures as well as with his wall drawings. Again, so a bit funny talking about Muybridge while looking at Donald Judd, but I do want to go ahead and move over to the Flavin. So we're going to follow this kind of circuitous path around and up some stairs, right? Yeah, Anne.
I was curious, I had seen something over here at the Kimball where they had a sculpture exhibition, and I don't know that much about art, but they would have, he the artist couldn't go and create the sculptures, so he would just say, here's what I want done.
Uh-huh.
And they would do it. So, like, I'm busy here in whatever part of Italy.
Right.
So it was kind of a similar thing.
Yes, yes. An artist, particularly, I think it's more expected in sculpture,
yeah,
because the materials are so difficult, like bronze casting, metal fabrication. I mean, look at that, the Roxy Payne stainless steel, yeah, treat, where it takes entire crews to make it. It's the wall drawing, the fact that, yeah, the fact that it was a drawing. Yeah, even though it had been done all the time during the Renaissance and Baroque, Rococo, you know, throughout all of the history of art, you have great masters who would work with entire workshops.
Mm-hmm. It's just,
right,
that.
It's just sort of in contemporary art. And I think it really had more to do with abstract expressionism, this idea of the authentic expression. So it was a way of negating it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So this is the last piece that we're going to talk about here today. I hope you enjoyed that view. It's a really lovely way to see the waterway. There was a Dan Flavin back in the conceptual galleries just around the corner. Did you get a chance to see it? I'll talk about it, and perhaps on your way down you can look at it. Sorry, I forgot to go around the corner. But this is the second artist I wanted to talk about. Dan Flavin was originally from New York, and he grew up going to his local museums. And he was mostly self-taught. But we see Flavin, he goes off to Korea in the 1950s. And he's actually in the Air Force, and so he's in the Air Weather Meteorological Corps, which I think is very fitting because it's about air and space and all of those things. And when he comes back, he takes a number of classes in art and art history. He goes to Columbia. He goes to the New School for Social Research. And then he takes a job at the Museum of Modern Art, an entry-level job. I think it's like elevator operator. If you might remember, I said Solowit was there as well as a I think he was a receptionist. So you notice there are a number of parallels to these artists, to their careers. These weren't guys freshly out of school. These are guys who had some experience in their lives. They'd been some places, they'd done some things. Flavin was raised Irish Catholic. And I think it's very interesting to make some parallels between his work and some Russian artists also working around the same time as Tatlin and Radchenko. And the artist I want to mention is Kazimir Milevich. Any of you ever heard of him? Okay, I've got the docents. Anybody else? Okay. Milevich forwarded an idea in art called suprematism, where he is reducing art to its most minimal elements. It's the purest form of art, but he's doing it with these mystical overtones. In 1915, so quite a ways back, he makes a painting of a black square on a white field. And for him, this is the ultimate, most supreme, most pure form of art. It is as if it is the face of God in art. It's this, the ultimate answer, reduction. And he hangs it in the corner in an exhibition in Petrograd in 1915. He was raised Russian Orthodox, and in a Russian Orthodox home, the icon would be hung in the corner. It is considered the Kragny Ugol. Sorry, my Russian's not very good. But it's called the beautiful corner. It also, because beautiful and red are the same word in Russian, it's also known as the red corner. So if you went into a Russian Orthodox home, you would be greeted when you walked in the door by an icon hanging in the east corner. I'm sorry to say, this is not the east corner. So this is where our analogy ends. But this is the far west corner. But he comes from this very devout place. He is imbuing his work with these mystical and spiritual overtones. And these are things that Flavin would have known about. Flavin, friends with Judd, thinking about industrial fabrication. He's also very aware of the work of Marcel Duchamp. I mentioned him earlier. When I say ready-made, do you know what that is? Anyone else here? Ready-made means a work of art, as Marcel Duchamp declared it, means that you can take any object that's already completed, like, say, a urinal at a hardware store, you can move it into a gallery, so we've got context, and then you can say, I declare this is my work of art. It's a ready-made. It was already made. I didn't make it. It's the ultimate removal of the hand. So Flavin takes partly this idea, a little bit of what's going on with his minimalist friends, and then a little bit of Malevich. And he's playing with light. Some of his earlier pieces seem really much more direct, making these analogies. He does a series called Icons. All right, so now we know exactly what he's thinking, Icons. And they are a series of boxes. So about 2 feet by 2 feet by 4 feet deep. It's a Masonite box painted red, painted yellow, painted one solid color. On top, he puts a light. So the one that's painted red has a red fluorescent light on top that's plugged in. It is literally plug-in art. He has another one that's yellow. It has a yellow incandescent light, well, just slightly off to the side. Okay, he's thinking about it. He's trying to figure out how do we make art that's modern, that's new, that is about light, it somehow goes into the viewer's space. I know, I'll just make a painting / construction and I'll put a light bulb on it. Yay, okay, I did it. I don't know, this looks kind of funny. This looks like I just stuck a light bulb on top of my art. Let's take away the art part. Let's just put the light bulb up. And so he does. He did that in his studio. And he had a commercially bought, went to the hardware store. I'm sure that's exactly what Duchamp did. He had to go to a hardware store. And he buys an 8-foot golden colored fluorescent light. And he's playing with it in the studio. And at one point, he puts it at a diagonal. And that's it. He's done. So the piece that's downstairs is called May 25th, 1963. That is the title, comma, made in 1963. And it is part of that series. The Modern owns one that's white, but he also made red, he made green, he made yellow. They're all from that same moment there. What do you see with this piece? Yes. I wanted to read to you. Flavin also wrote about his work. Aren't we lucky? He wrote a poem in 1961, so 2 years before the diagonal of May 25th, 1963. And he says, "Fluorescent poles shimmer, shiver, flick out, dim, monuments of on and off art." Isn't that great? And I read it like that because he literally stacked the words on top of each other. And he had them slightly sort of going off and then a space and then there and then there, 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 and down. This is called a concrete poem. So it's a poem that looks like what it's about. It sort of slightly shifting around the page, but it, on the whole, makes a column like his art. Does, even though it takes a little while before he's able to process that. Flavin is very aware of how the light is going to transform the space. It literally makes this kind of aura around it. Here, he's using it to transform a corner. And again, we've talked about the importance of a corner to icons. We've also talked a little bit about complementary colors, so what can you tell me about this piece? About optical blending. Anybody? What are the colors you see on the exterior? Right. Mm-hmm. Right, so we have this blue, and it says it's yellow, I think it's kind of orange. But we know, if we think about the color wheel, that we'll say blue and yellow, orange. They're basically opposite each other, so they're going to vibrate most strongly together. And then on the other side, if you get close enough, you can see it's green and pink, sort of this, or red, violet, and sort of green, yellow. Again, they're opposite each other. Now, if you've ever played with watercolor or with paints or whatever, anybody here? Any painters? Even if it's just finger paint. Okay, what happens when you mix your colors together in finger paint?
Right.
So when you are studying art, you learn that the fastest way to make brown is to combine your complementary colors together. And that's... They will muddy up each other. You add all the colors together and you get this horrible brown black color. That's how it works with pigment. With light, it's the opposite. When you add complementary colors together, they become lighter. You add all the colors together and you didn't make black, you just made white. So I think that's very interesting what he's doing here with this. And we have other examples of him making corner pieces in order to dissolve the light itself. I wanted to mention one more piece that Flavin did. We talked a little bit about the diagonal that's downstairs, but I wanted to show you this one. And this is called the Nominal 3. There you go. Nominal 3, dedicated to William of Ockham. Anybody know who William of Ockham is? Occam's razor, very good. All right, we all knew that, right? 14th century English philosopher who came up with a maxim basically saying that if it's vain to do something with more when it could have been done with less. So economy versus excess, I think, is a more succinct way to do it. Well, that was his idea, and from that they come up with Occam's razor, basically saying the same. Economy. So we have one, one, two, one, two, three. Here. He's able to illuminate the entire room. He's able to set up the idea of a series, that it's serial, and he's able to establish that with the minimum number of objects. Have any of you seen the work of James Turrell? That's a... We'll take anything. Turrell, right? Then Turrell in Houston, right now at the MFA. It just opened June 9th, so about a month ago. It will be up until September. It's about 4.5 hours, maybe a little bit more from Fort Worth, but definitely well worth the trip. Because he is the opposite of Flavin, and I think it's great to see that contrast between the two. It's a retrospective at the Museum of Fine Art in Houston, and he sets up a Ganzfeld, and that alone is worth the trip. A Ganzfeld is this idea of losing your depth perception. So he is altering the architecture in radical ways and setting up light and programming and all kinds of really complicated electronics in order to create the feeling, when you're standing in it, of having no depth perception. I mean, imagine snow blindness, but with color. So incredible amount of manipulation. Compare that to Donald Judd. Dan Flavin. Sorry. To Dan Flavin here. And I think that's why I wanted to mention Occam's razor, the idea of economy versus excess. We have these beautiful, rich colors from store-bought fluorescent light bulbs. They were always store-bought. They're not custom. He would only use the colors that you could find in a store. So I know out of time, so if there are any questions.
I was just wondering, I know about what I can see, but I can't remember what the deal is with this, but what I can see, which is the source of the electricity.
Thank you, Fred.
I'm going to have to look to Aaron or Terry on this one.
When you go downstairs and see the diagonal on the 25th of May, you'll notice it's very conspicuous, the light source. It's just plugged in the wall, they're kind of crude. And then when you juxtapose it with this, I don't have the answer, but very carefully concealed it, made a decision to not show the source of the light. And if we can imagine this really thick black wire hanging down from this piece, what that would do to it for us.
Right.
It would be much different.
Right, and I think that's an important decision that the artist makes. Any artist that's working with electronics, that tail cord, literally the tail that's coming out of the piece, becomes a drawing on the wall, whether you wanted it to or not. And so it's up to each artist to decide what to do with that. Flavin referred to his work as proposals rather than sculptures. He considered it to be situational. So he was very sensitive to the architecture. I think this sort of dramatic approach that we just took to this piece, that would be really stunning at night, don't you think? That would have been very, very dramatic and very appropriate to this piece. So are there any other questions?
The artist who wrote instructions, it sounds like they weren't very specific at all. Not only did they not specify color, but they didn't specify medium, or did I?
He said colored pencil. He said three colored pencils.
I didn't hear.
Yeah.
Did he specify the size?
No.
But he didn't specify that lines, thin lines drawn.
Right.
1/8
Right. Some of the instructions, after a while, he realizes perhaps I should have a little bit more oversight. So they become a little bit more detailed. But on the whole, that was just part of the deal. It was going to be open to interpretation, and even to the point where he's separating himself and saying, "Even if I'm the draftsman, then if I'm drawing this, then it might come out differently than I thought it would have, and that's not a good or a bad thing." He's completely neutral about it.
Is that his only sanctioned interpretation of that instruction, or does he have multiple ones of that same one in different places? Or?
It's been around since 1970, so I'm sure it's been existed in multiple permutations. The modern acquired it in 2010. So, very interesting thoughts. I hope you enjoyed learning more about these two artists. I thought they had certain commonalities, and hopefully you could see that as we went along. Thank you.